Hello, and welcome to another Meta Media Group production of On Purpose Magazine, featuring interesting, inspiring, educational, and entertaining stories, discussions, and interviews of purpose, with purpose, on purpose.
Hello, everybody. This is J.W. Najarian with On Purpose Magazine, and today we're going to be talking to Don M. Green, who is the CEO, 13 years, I understand, maybe 14 years now, Don, of the Napoleon Hill Foundation. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. I'm in my 13th year right now.
Your 13th year. That's quite a long time.
Well, I spent 38 in banking, so I'm about to tell you my age.
Yeah, and for those who don't know Don or Napoleon Hill Society, we're going to get into that. First, you're a resident of Wise, Virginia, if I understand, to the birthplace of Napoleon Hill. Don Green brings nearly 45 years of banking, finance, and entrepreneurship experience to his role as executive director of the Napoleon Hill Foundation. Since 2000, Mr. Green has traveled worldwide and used his finance skills to grow the foundation's funds in order to continue the foundation's educational outreach to prisons. Green has both modeled leadership skills as a CEO and taught them through the PMA Science of Success course at the University of Virginia's College at Wise. And I understand that's where you're at today. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. We're actually our officer on campus of the university.
So tell me, Don, first of all, I got you on today because you just wrote a new book, and I wanted to talk about that. But just to set the story and the stage, couple things. What is the Napoleon Hill Society to start with?
Foundation. We're a nonprofit, and of course the motto is making the world a better place and wish to live. It was organized in 1962 as a nonprofit, and on Hill's death, everything went to his wife, and then, of course they had made arrangements, and then she gave all the copyrights to the foundation to carry on the work. And that's what we've been doing since that period of time, and it's got better each year.
Well, that's great. I mean, you're in finance. You live out there. I'm sure that you read, as many people do, Napoleon Hill's book, Think and Grow Rich. He's kind of the father of the whole modern genre of personal success literature. Is that what happened to you? You saw it, you read the book, you liked Napoleon Hill, and you tried to get in there. What's the story of how you got in there?
I never wrote it on the wall, but I was probably about 20 years old. I was always a lover of books. I read the inspirational books. In school, I read all the library books on George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abe Lincoln, and Booker T. Washington, and the successful people. And then I read Hill's books, and then realizing he was from Wise also, and not many people around here knew who he was, I guess it excited me even more. And not only did I make a habit of reading everything he ever wrote, I tried to read everything that he read also. You know, he was influenced by people like Samuel Smiles, who wrote the first self-help book in 1859, and then Orson Swett Marden, Elbert Hubbard, Warren Hilton, who founded the School of Applied Psychology, and he was influenced by a lot of other people, and so I tried to read them also to see where he got his thoughts from.
Well, so you got totally immersed. So kind of tell me the story of how you went from high finance and all that to actually being CEO of the foundation.
Well, you know, I was a bank president, and people would ask me to knew that I had talked about Napoleon Hill, and I was asked to speak at a historical society, and when I come home that night, I said, there's two things I remember thinking back. They never fed me, and they sure never paid me. But I wrote a letter out that night to scribble it out on a pad. And when I went into the bank the next morning, I asked the secretary to type it up and mail it out. And I sent it to the foundation, and we're located in Chicago, then Northbrook, Illinois, edge of Chicago. And I got a reply. I basically told them what I'd been doing. And they told me they'd pay my expenses. They would like to talk to me. And I was anxious to meet W. Clement Stone, who was chairman of the board. I knew his background. He, you know, he's was probably a billionaire at one time. He was close to one when he died, even though he gave away several $100 million. And I was anxious to meet him, and I had dinner with him, and I remember him telling me, he said, told me that I knew more about them books than he did, that I ought to be a board member. And I said, well, Mr. Stone, what do I got to do? And he said, just attend the meetings, and that's just what I did. But then when we sold, had the guys wanted to sell the bank that had helped organize the thing, and we're getting up in years, and they wanted to sell the bank, and I didn't want to go to another banking. I'd been at it a long time, and I saw a chance to sell all my stock and my options and what have you. And the other guys who run the foundation was getting up in years and couldn't travel. And they said, we really need somebody to run the foundation. Can't think of nobody that knows the material like you do. And I said, guys, I can do that. I hadn't planned on it, but I said, I can do that. Mm-hmm. But I would like to move the foundation out of Chicago. I don't want to live in Chicago. And they said, can you do that? I said, well, I don't own all these books, so all I need to do is transfer the money down here. And so that's what we did, and it's just been absolutely great. Because when I started, basically, they were in Japan, but the rest of it was United States. And today we're doing business with approximately 200 foreign publishers in every country you can imagine.
Yeah, do you have other foundation offices, like in Australia and things
yeah,
like that, too?
We have people that are associated with us, but not for us, belong to us. The only other office that we physically own is on Purdue's campus in Calumet, Indiana, in Hammond, at Purdue University. The library was built there. It was built there. It was built there before we moved down here, and they house the books and so forth, and our educational courses and so forth are handled out of there, in addition to our website and our internet and our social media is handled out of the seminar and so forth, are handled out of the office in Indiana.
Wonderful. Don, you know, you're writing books, and we'll get into that in a second, but tell me what you do with the foundation. Since you know the subject so well, do you help teach, or do you do all the administrative work? Tell me how the foundation's working and what you guys are working on.
We also mentioned
prisons. I'd love to bring that in.
Well, when I was in banking, I organized a class. I called it Keys to Success. Didn't want to call it Think and Grow Rich, a three-hour course, and I sold the business department on it, and I taught it 12 times when I was banking. And then the governor asked me to be a board member of the college, which meant I couldn't teach it no more. It's still been taught. It's probably been taught 20-some years. I don't know exactly what year it was, but it's taught both semesters, and it's a three-hour course covering all the principles of success. But my job is primarily is to create products and to license our books and to negotiate with the foreign publishers and to grow the business and make deals on whether it be audios or foreign rights or what have you. Of course, we have a full time copyright attorney who works for us also.
Well, you have great authors. I mean, you've done a great job. You have great authors like Greg Reed and Sharon Lecter. She helped you guys bring out Outwitting the Devil by Napoleon Hill, a book that had been in, I guess, seclusion for many, many years. And then Greg Reed with his 3 Feet to Gold that he co-wrote with Sharon. And, I mean, these are all best-selling masterpiece books and game changers. So you guys are putting out some quality material.
Well, that's what we want to continue to do. If you ever visit my office, I'll show you the Outwitting the Devil manuscripts on my back shelf in a big red binder with a gold lettering stamped on it, Outwitting the Devil. It probably had more than just a few people that seen the manuscript till I called Sharon one day and told her I wanted to do this book, and I'd like her to take a look at it, and I didn't send it to her. I made a copy of it and sent it because I didn't want to risk losing it. And she sat up all night and she said it'd be all anything she ever read. So it's done real great. And a book should have you what we call the shelf life. It's how long that book sells. A lot of people get a book and it's pumped up for a few months or a few weeks,
right,
or what have you, and may hit some list or what have you, and then it drops off the end of the cliff, so to speak. But Hill's mm-hmm. books keep on selling. The Devil book and 3 Feet from Gold book, both are still selling real well. Each one of them, as of this time, have been licensed in somewhere in the neighborhood of 20-25 foreign languages already.
It's really crazy because the stickability of a book, the books are over 50 years old, whether it be Think and Grow Rich or, Outwitting the Devil just came out a few years ago, and it was... And it still brings up controversy and, hits marks and explodes truisms that we still have troubles with today. I mean, Napoleon Hill was either way ahead of his time or just one lucky sucker who fell in, who figured it out. I'm not really sure, but it sounds like he's just really, he really figured it out. And I guess truth is timeless. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, and that's a standard answer I give to people that ask about, one guy called me and said, I was going to read that book, but said, I saw it written in 1937, things have changed so much. And I said, well, let me ask you something other. If you're on the 10th story of a building, you're out on a ledge and you step off, what's going to happen? He said, well, I'll probably kill myself. I said, well, that's called law of gravity. And I said, the principles says the same thing. They have not changed. They go all the Bible time or whatever. It's golden rule that we talk about in the Bible. I said, you don't get something unless you give something. You don't go to the garden and pick corn unless you've planted corn. And I said, he just wrote about some things. And, of course, he had help, like he read Samuel Smiles, basically a book on called Self-Help Psychology. It's basically stories of people to overcome adversity. But the difference in him and Hill was, Hill actually interviewed the people. He actually studied people that were successful and also people that were unsuccessful and to see what the difference was. And he was haunted with that. Why are some people successful and others not? And he spent a lifetime of doing that and recorded it for us to use today.
And I'd love to bring up that in Outwitting the Devil, he really kind of, at least the first chapters, and with the help of Sharon Lecter, who really gets kind of into explaining it in between, he really gets into his life because a lot of people don't know his life. They know him as a guy who interviewed a bunch of rich people and took their principles and put them forth as these are the success principles that people use to get successful. But he also became successful and then lost it all and get back. And so, I mean, he's kind of he's the story within the story, and he really tells it in that particular book. Does he not? Besides the second part of the book where he gets very political.
I read a quote from Richard DeVos, the guy that founded Amway, and he said, he's talking about that very same thing he said was, he said if he got knocked down 70 times, he'd say, here comes number 71. Where he's bouncing back, and I think that's a true that's a true statement. There's nobody that doesn't have some obstacles in their life. But for the benefit of those people, I'm working on a deal, and I had to get some information together for the attorneys. But these people tell us that the Hill, he read this stuff, he died broke. Well, it's just as it's amazing the stuff that's out there. Hill's widow, the will was it was $1.4 million. I didn't include none of the book rights or anything, which she gave to the foundation, which I don't know what the value of those was. But then, and that didn't include cash, which she had set up in her accounts and with her relatives. So when she passed along, it was outside the estate. But the estate itself was $1,400,000. So he did okay. Especially considering the background, the background that he grew up in. I mean, he grew up in an area, when there were only a few 4-year high schools in the country, and of course the one he attended was a two-year high school, and school attendance wasn't mandatory. And basically, even his father thought when he got big enough, you got 13, 14 year old, get your job in the mines. You got enough, you can count, and you can read. That's all you need. And that was what was pretty well thought of working class people, and everybody was meant to go work.
Right. That's what everybody's saying now is the old scenario. It's like the big lie is that you work, you go out and get a job for 40 years, get your pension, and you're done. It worked at one time.
That's true. Of course, he was inspired by his stepmother, who was an educated woman. That made all the difference in the world, because she was a widow of a high school principal, and her father was a doctor. So she was educated. So she made a lot of changes in the family and inspired Hill. So that made all the difference in the world.
Absolutely. And let me ask you, because you have these authors that are like Greg Reed, and I understand from Greg's last book that he did with you guys, and I'm trying to recall the name of it right now. Stickability, is that, or that's the one that's actually coming up, the new one?
That's the one's coming out September 10th, I believe, yes.
Yeah, and that's from you guys, where he gets more, he gets into, what perseverance is all about, because you do end up failing forward in order to succeed. You have to fail in order to succeed. And the thing is, just like 3 feet from gold, you have to persevere. You have to have consistent persistence, and that's one of the big messages is
Well, something happens. I just did an interview with some college business students, and some of the questions they asked me, I said I don't know what happens, but when a child's 9 months old or 10 or 12 learn to walk, it falls, bumps its head, and what have you, but the parents encourage it, they clap for it, and it takes one or two steps, they call it pretty baby and so forth and all. But as they get a little bit bigger, they want to avoid any risk taking. Don't go swimming until you know how to swim and all these other things. And what do you mean you want to go to that college? Are you crazy? You know how much it costs to go to that school? Rather than finding out why they want to go and then trying to figure out the hell, we start, and it limits them. And I told them, as they started to leave, that they were doing an interview, I said, the last thing you want to remember is to take no risk is the biggest risk of all. Mm-hmm. And so many people are trying to avoid taking any risk. I don't mean we'll go off half crazy without having the facts, but you have to make calculated risk, for these people. I said in banking, put your money in a mattress, well, a house could burn up. You can get robbed. There's all kinds of things can happen in it. The bank can go broke if you put it in a bank. You can lose if you put it in the stock market. But to take no risk at all is taking the biggest risk of all. And you've got to be able to assume risk and to move forward and not count them as failures, but simply as lessons learned.
No, those are great words to live by, because there's no sure thing and there's no free lunch. So
no.
You got to take those risks.
No. And if you learn to look at them as lessons, but so many people, they're looking to see if somebody's going to be embarrassed, and somebody's looking, they're looking behind their shoulders, and then at their wife or their spouse or somebody knows going to say, oh, I told you, it wouldn't work, and you ought to know better, and your brother-in-law said, what makes him think he can go back to college, or, stuff like that, and I believe, I always remember what Mark Twain said. He said, don't walk away from negative people. He said, run from them. And I think it's pretty good advice, because, we're a product of our environment. If you got a chance to associate with a bunch of people like attends one of Greg's Secret Knocks or something or other, or you want to hang out with a bunch of losers, you can become one of them by just hanging around them enough. You'll begin to think like they do. You'll develop an attitude that you can't get ahead today. We all know the taxes is too high. The government's anti-business. People are dishonest. It's too hard to make it today. Everything costs too much. You can go on and on and on. Because if you're a failure, you have to prepare your list of excuses.
Right.
But the good thing about being a success, it explains itself. And you don't have to make up no excuses. It explains itself.
Well, my Nana used to say to me, which I always thought was great, and that was a positive plus a positive equal a positive, and then negative plus a negative equal a negative. But a positive plus a negative always equals negative. So when you, even if you're a positive person around negative people and you think you can change them, give it up. Move on.
No, don't waste your time. It's an old saying, but they said one rotten apple messes up the whole barrel, and that's
right.
The true fact is, you have some fruit in your refrigerator, and that one starts rotten, and if you'll notice it, the one beside of it, it touches it, it starts rotten, and also, and it spreads. So mm-hmm. You need to get that one rotten one and throw it out, and that's the same way with it. Same way with at work, you can let one negative person be going around saying he thinks we can make that budget. Is he crazy or something like that? Rather than being a part of it, and when you get somebody like that, it can hurt the whole organization.
Right.
And
I just want to say, Don, because I want to finish up with, because I was trying to make a point about Greg Reed, and I apologize, we kind of went off on a tangent, but I wanted to point out that I understand Greg is now, you guys have kind of have him moving ahead to continue the mission of Napoleon Hill, to continue putting out really good content. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, there's several things, you know, like I turned around there and looked at that one day, and I saw that 3 feet from gold story, and I'd always thought that would make a good story. And I had a friend, Charlie Jones, and he said, when you have something come up, see if you can involve Greg in something. And I got a hold of Greg, and we worked on it a while, and we made a trip to New York, and we wasn't able to sell it. And so, and Sharon, and I'd met Sharon, and I said, Sharon, I said, we could use some help on this book, finish it off and all, and promote it. And so I did the we did that one together, and then when Greg and I had a project going on Stickability, while let Sharon do the edit the and animate the Outwitting the Devil, and yeah, we'll continue. I'll continue to do some stuff with Sharon and Greg if they see fit. It's been a good relationship because we know we're making a difference, and we can see what the results are. I'll be doing another book with Sharon before very long. It's in the stage, and then like I said, we got Stickability, which by the way is a term that come out of one of Hill's old stuff, is where that word come from. Was an actual word used. Of course, we all know what it means. And you know, I published some of Hill's books on my own. I've done three out of his magazines, which have done real well. One of them's in 36 languages, and the other's in 20 or 25 languages. And then, of course, I got my book coming out April the 5th, which I guess.
Yeah, let's talk about that. That's Everything I Know About Success I Learned from Napoleon Hill. Tell me about that. How did that come about? And we'll get into what it means.
You know, I've spoken Jamaica and Costa Rica and Japan three times, Germany a couple of times, and China three times, Singapore, Malaysia three times. I travel a lot, and people would ask me, and basically when I talk was, I mean, I basically told stories, and people started saying, you ought to put that in a book, you ought to put that in a book. And I thought, well, you know, I don't need the money, but I can make it be a copyright of the foundation. And we do scholarships. I've been down 12 scholarships here, plus professorships in Hill's name, plus we do a lot of prison work. I said, the foundation can use some money, and I believe we can make some money on it. So the people that looked at it was excited, McGraw-Hill, and it'll come out April 5th. I sent an email out, and today I got my 23rd foreign publisher wanting to take a look at the book, and I don't even have the book yet. All I have is a PDF file, but I got Saudi Arabia and Bulgaria today. But I've had it'll end up being in lots and lots of foreign languages. But basically, J.W., what I did was I told stories. I mean, you know, I'm a good example of an entrepreneur. My dad was a coal miner with a seventh grade education. We never had a bathroom in the house while I was in high school. So, I mean, I grew up, but I learned how to make money at an early age. I mean, an early age. By the time I was in high school, I helped my oldest brother buy his first house. So I caught on real quick, and, of course, and it carried over into banking. I was a bank president when I was 41 years old. But believe me, if you work your way up and it wasn't handed to you, that's an early age, and I've done that for 18 years. But I've done lots of things. I've been part of founding the cable TV, spring water, dry cleaning business, real estate development, including to Walmart and people like that. So I've done lots of businesses in addition to being banking 30 years and run the foundation. So I think I learned a lot in this and tried to share it in that book. I mean, just think, there's 350 million people in this country, and I end up as CEO of the Napoleon Hill Foundation. I wrote about that because sometimes we have to create our own opportunities. Right. There wouldn't nobody running ads or come looking for me in a town with three red lights to run the Napoleon Hill Foundation.
No.
I did the background, I studied the material, and I wrote them a letter, and they asked me to come to Chicago, and that was the beginning of it. In other words, sometimes our ship don't come in. Sometimes we have to swim out where it is. You know, we have to create our own opportunities. So I gave lessons of the value of books. I got a wonderful story in there. A guy gave me $250,000 because he had read our books. I took his phone call from Nigeria, and I sent him a couple books by FedEx. He wired me $100,000, and then I asked him to come and visit me. He came and visited me. He brought me another $150,000. And so that's a chapter on the power of books. I mean, these other stories are on books, but I wrote on being self-reliant growing up as a kid. I told stories about being self-reliant, about the businesses I had. They wrote me up in the newspapers about running my zoo. I had a reptile garden when I was in high school. In a zoo, I had black bears, bobcats, monkeys, exotic birds, and all this stuff. And I'm just a punk kid, you make $100 a day. You think you're making big money back then. I'd done everything. Christmas time, you didn't have that business. I cut Christmas trees and drug them out of the woods and sold mistletoe, built a fire beside the road. You know, I cut mining timbers for coal mines. You name it, and I've done it. But I got real, real good at making money, and it carried over into banking. I took a bank that they had $35,000 in capital. They came in to close it when they hired me, and I made $90,000 the first year. Then I made like $300,000. Then I was making $1 million a year after taxes, and I don't know. I guess hard work was one of them, but things just. Things just clicked, but I wrote about other things. I affected the name change of college here. We used to be a community college called Clinch Valley College, and it was associated with the University of Virginia, but nobody knew it. So we had to go to the legislature. Me and three other guys, we approached the legislature on it and went up and met with those people and sold them on the, you know, it became law. I had to go in front of the legislature, and I think the vote was 36-6. But, you know, I did some things other than just make money that I think are that people seem to think are interesting stories that I hope somebody can learn from. You know, and that was the whole bit in doing it is not to ego or say look how great I am, to say mm-hmm. Hey, my God, if I could background I have if I can be a success. And I never felt like writing a book until I lived it. The book starts off saying like Henry David Thoreau said, the reason I never sat down to write a book, I had not yet stood up to live. And I lived the life before I ever wrote about it. So many of these people haven't done anything except write, you know. So it was real easy for me. I just told some of my stories.
And you are a storyteller. We spoke the other day, just a pre-interview, just to meet you, Don, and we got into a really lengthy discussion about everything from hunting to stuff down south, and it was just a really interesting conversation because you are a great storyteller, and that's the best way to write a book on success, I think, is
that all of our history come that way is because we remember stories. I mean, you know, if somebody reads my book and they can't remember the story about my bear getting out when I'm in school, I mean, a kid read that and is going to understand it. I thought it was the funniest thing on earth. I liked to got a bunch of people killed. And looking back, he could have killed somebody. He did kill one of my big ducks that was running loose, but he could have actually killed somebody. You know, weighed 450 pounds. You know, a big black bear. You know, running around the grass and the traffic backed up forever, and what have you. And here I am with a box of Little Debbie cakes leading him back to his cage. I thought it was the funniest thing on earth, and I got him back to his cage, and I got one cake left, and I pitched it in the door, and I didn't get it in there very far, and so he sticks his head in there. He's going to get it, and he's going to back out. And I kicked him in the butt, and he jumped in there, and I shut the door and put the padlock in it. I got in there and played with him that morning, and I'm sure I fed him. I'd shut the door, but I hadn't put the padlock in, and, you know, had to run home and take a shower and hitchhike to school of a morning, and I'd failed to do that, and he'd leaned against it, he'd come open, and he was a free bear, but he didn't know how to act. You know, he was just running around the grass and running around, you know, and I said he did kill one of my big ducks that was running loose, but the monkeys, I had three monkeys at the time, they were skrilling, I never heard them make a noise in all my life. Of course, they were in cages, they were the other birds, and everything was going wild, and my mother saying, you're going to get somebody killed, you're going to get somebody killed, and she wondered if they had beaten me to death, but to me it was just a funny incident.
You had one heck of a mom who would let you do all that.
Well, you know, we had a sister that was a little doll and learned to play the piano, and what they, boys, but, you know, growing up, dad a coal miner and all like that. We grew up pretty rough, you know, in the woods and you know, us camping was laying on a riverbank, laying on some ferns rather than a tent and what have you, and fishing and fixing to fix it over open fire, and you know it wasn't It wasn't going out and standing in a place and then going to a restaurant and sit down and eating. It was a rough life, but you know, I mean, that's what it was back. That was what it was back then. But it was a good upbringing. You know, I can tell the story about putting water in my dad's house. We never had water in the house when I was probably 16 or something or other.
Uh-huh.
He built a house, borrowed $4,000, the only time he ever borrowed money in his life, and built a house, and we couldn't get water. It was a spring located about a half a mile away, and he told us to dig an 18-inch deep ditch, and we dug it with mattocks and hand tools, and he worked in the mines of a day, and we dug that thing up to the road, and the house was on the other side of US 23, which at the time was a main road running from Detroit to Florida. And we took picks and dug through that asphalt and dug across the road. Never got a permit, never got permission, never done nothing except block off one side of the road. And then of a night, we'd have to put the sand back in and keep them wrecking their cars. And we finally got it done. And after we had it done, one of the state highway departments stopped and wanted to know who dug a ditch across the road. And, of course, I was proud. I said, me and my brother. And he said, where's your permit at? And I said, a what? He said, you got to have a permit, son, to cross a U.S. highway. I said, my dad never said nothing about it. I said, we didn't have no water, but we got water now. And he just kind of smiled. He said, well, I'll send some of the guys out here to patch it over. So we never had no tar and gravel. All we could put in was dirt and put gravel on top of it. And, of course, the gravel kept getting kicked out, and it was kind of a little rough bump when you travel the road. But you know, people don't do stuff like it today. They would have got an attorney or went to the courthouse or got hold of a congressman or something and complained or drawed picket or something that didn't have water. Dad knew what we didn't have no water, and he knew how to solve it, and that's what we did.
Well, Don, let's talk about that a little bit, because your book is, you know, Success. Everything I Know About Success I Learned from Napoleon Hill. And you talked about your daddy being a coal miner, and you know, there's an old saying that says, you know, if hard work made you successful, then all coal miners would be rich. So there's more to success than just working hard. There's the perseverance, of course. There's being honest because your word is your bond, and people need to know that. Or it's very hard to be successful long term in sustainable ways. Tell me about some of the other points that you know, besides just being persevering and working real hard.
Of course, that's part of it, working hard and perseverance. But I think you got to come up with somebody that there's only two ways to make money. You got to have a service that somebody's willing to pay for, or you got to have a product. Now, if you've got a service like coal miner that everybody else out there has got, it's probably not real competitive. You know, you can basically take what they offer you, and that's it. But if you've got a product that you can improve on, that you can you can do it cheaper, get it to your hands better, make it more appealing to someone or another, you can get a different price out of it. And so you got to be creative, and you got to come up with something other that somebody wants. Not only do they want it enough to which they're willing to take money out of their pocket and give to it. And you'll find that there's not necessarily a limit on that. I mean, you know, you can have a little greasy spoon and probably sell a, God knows, growing up cheeseburger for a quarter. But you know, these places, I'm sure they sell them for what, $2 or $3. But they sell fancy restaurants with a nice decor and so forth and all. Selling hamburgers and fries up to, I seen Colin the other day at some, one of the places in California, getting $30 for a hamburger and fries, but they've done something else to it. You know, they've got the surroundings, for it to be the artwork, furniture, the music, the help, or whatever, to make it appealing to people who want to pay that. So you got to use your mind to think,
right.
You know, how can I get them people to turn loose some money? And that's the reason that coal mining, everybody out there, basically the men, they do the same thing. They're, you know, they load coal or do that job, and they tell them what the wages is, and you take that, or you know, you go on. Somebody else sets the price, but you mm-hmm. can set your own price within reason if you can add to something or another or change it through the thought process, create something other that didn't exist, or improve on something that's already there.
Well, let me ask you, Don, because, you know, making money for the bank, you learn how to make money whether it was selling something, offering a service. One of the things that happens today, a lot of success books talk about different ways of selling, because used to be that you want to meet everybody's objections, and then people kind of got got into the, they kind of got used to being pushed to sell, and they didn't like it. So as soon as you came up and you started doing that, they ran from you. You know, MLMs are famous for people, you know, running away from the Amway people kind of thing. You mentioned DeVos earlier, because these people just, they wanted to, they put on the hard sell on you. So now the whole new paradigm, supposedly the new paradigm is, well, no, let's listen to your customer. Let's see what they want. Don't hard sell anymore. You know, just talk really nice to them, and don't be pounding the sale on them all the time. But in order to get things done, and you would know this better than anybody, don't you need a little of both? Somewhere along the line, you have to be willing to ask for the sale, whether you got best widget in the world or not, right?
Yeah, you know, Jeffrey Gilmore, a good friend, you know, he wrote the little sales book, read the sales book. It's his background. And he wrote the book How to Sell Your Way Through Life, which is on selling. The first thing we've got to do is sell ourselves. And even right. Selling cars or whatever, you've got to sell. You've got to sell yourself. Yeah, it takes a little bit. For example, you have to ask for the sale, but also you have to be persistent. So the fact is that the people who sell life insurance or sell anything is they don't let a simple no deter them. And of course, you can't be hard. You can't be hard nosed about the thing. But you do have to be persistent, because you call on somebody one time and they didn't buy. That don't mean that circumstances don't change. You don't just sometimes it's people who call the second, third, fourth, or fifth time that makes the sale, because the person either was busy, it didn't appeal to them, they've had time to think about it, or what have you. But yeah, you got to ask for the sale. But I think the biggest thing is you got to sell yourself as well as sell the product. And I think people have built up a sales resistance that people do what you said, try to be hard sell, and rather than selling themselves by trying to get on the side of the customer by finding out what the customer really wants, by asking the customer questions. You know, said, in your work, do you use a small pickup or do you use large trucks? Are you off-road vehicles? Your trucks, are they highway vehicles? You know, and ask questions and know more about the customer, because that customer, he's sitting over saying, God, this guy, he's really interested in me. He ain't just trying to sell me something or other. He's wanting to know about my business and what I do. This guy seems to really have an interest in what I'm doing. You know, so I think it helps make it easier, because we know in life insurance or anything else, a few percentage of people do the most of the sales.
And that's an interesting lesson I learned years ago. I was selling software to the home, to the appraisal market, real estate appraisal market, and I couldn't sell this software to save my life. I went to every appraiser, I went to appraiser meetings and conferences, and nobody was buying my stuff. And then one of the big appraisers in Los Angeles, he noticed me, said, "Hey, I tell you what, I know what your problem is. It's that you don't know the industry very well. Come work for me for a couple months as an intern. I'll show you the industry, and then I got a feeling you'd sell a little more if you knew what we were going through." So I sat in his office for a couple months and, worked from the bottom up and learned a little bit about the business itself. And when I went out, I knew what to say to the appraiser. "Hey, you know when you have problems with this and that? Well, this fixes that. This helps that. This takes that problem away." And I was selling the things like hotcakes, and it was just a matter of me, knowing what to ask.
Well, I think most of the sales are done by simply asking questions and learning to ask the right questions.
Yeah, no, that's a very important lesson. The other one is, you talk about persistence and perseverance. One of my sales mentors talked to me about top-of-mind awareness, and that is everybody thinks the sales cycle is a very easy cycle where somebody, let's say computer sales, you have time to go in and, if you're going to get new computers, you have time to go shop around, find the best price, get the best company, and then make your choice and you buy it, and that's what happens. But the truth is that the sales cycle works more like a cliff, not a bell. In other words, they want to get new equipment, they know they need new equipment. You show up every month, you hand them your card, you say, "Hey, here I am, I'm still here, here's my card," and they throw it in the wastebasket. They say, "We're not interested, go away, why do you keep coming back, we keep telling you no." But you keep going back every month. And then one day, their computer breaks. And they know they need something now. They don't have time to shop around. They don't have time to get to know anybody. But your card is sitting in the guy's drawer because you come back every month. He goes, where's that guy's card? Pay him whatever he wants. Get our thing fixed.
Well, definitely persistence is a great part of it, simply of doing it. I can remember I did a fundraiser with Zig Ziglar once up in Pennsylvania, and I remember him talking about when he was selling cookware. And he said that, if you're not careful, you'll get into driving driving an ad. And people said that don't even look like there's many lights on there. They're probably not nobody home, so you don't even stop. Or you tell yourself this is not a good part of town. I'm gonna drive on the other part of town, and what have you. Or you get so timid and so been rejected that when you do get the nerve up to go, you ring a doorbell and you hope there's nobody home. you can be your own worst enemy.
Right.
I look at the attitude that Babe Ruth, and I know you've heard the analogy, one of the sports writers asked him, said, Babe, what do you think about when you strike out? He said, I'm beginning to feel sorry for the next picture I face because it's time for me to hit a home run. And so now I think that's the same way with in sales. Just nothing else than math involved. If a guy's doing the same things and he calls on 20 different people versus some guy that calls on three, chances are the guy that calls on 20 is going to get rejected a lot more, but also the chances is he's going to get more sales too. And so I think it's an important point of just simply hard work and perseverance, knowing that everybody is not going to buy, but you don't know whether that guy's ready or not. That's the reason, like you said, you call on him. Not that your circumstance as a salesperson has changed. You got the same product, you got the same pitch and what have you, but the guy that you're trying to sell to him, circumstances has changed in his bit. He either needs the product now or his finances changed. He has time to listen to you or what have you. And so that's the reason you keep going back to see that his time is appropriate for you, that you don't go call on some guy twice and don't go back. And some other guy is the third and fourth call he gets, and they end up buying them because he's going to buy from the last guy that's in front of him.
Right. Yeah, I remember Zig Ziglar's story about he got a job, when he first got his job selling pots and pans, they all went out, all the salesmen went out in the street, and he said, why didn't you guys stop at this house? And they go, oh, they never buy.
Yeah.
So that was his first sale. He decided,
when you want to stop it. And recently, his cookware, when I was in the finance business back in, God knows, 61, 62, that was a good part of our business. They basically sold for about $3.99. These people like Zig would go cook, the women that basically they're selling the sizzle. In truth, it was probably a $39 set of cookware that got at Sears, but they were buying that meal and all. They prepare a big meal, and, the lady that has it, she invites 8 or 10 guests in, and she gets a gift for bringing them in and so forth. And he has the paper right there with him, but they can sign it, and then he fills out a little data, and then those guys would turn it into the finance company, and we collect the payments, and, of course, he'd get paid for it. And what I did was I held 20% reserve. So if I did a $400 deal, $399, basically hold out 20%, same as $80. You're holding reserve. That's saying that one out of every five goes bad, you're still okay because you're getting interest on them. And of course, we'd let the reserve build up, and then, if we hadn't used it or they hadn't had this go bad, we'd settle up with them every 6 months or so. But it was fun because it fed our business and the finance business, because once we got a contract for cookware on the books, we could discover how that guy promptly was paid, and then we could solicit him for the small loan business. So when he talked about the cookware, that brought back memories to me, because I've done that many a time. We did cookware and did vacuum cleaners and so forth, basically stuff that people sold door to door.
Wow. That's interesting, because like you were talking about earlier, success, rules and laws don't change, and neither do business laws, whether you're selling this product, that product, or a service, the laws are the laws, right?
No, and I said you can equate it to your, I'm doing a book on personal finance sometime. I'll do that, finish it after my other book's been out a while, but But, you know, if you're having business, same thing as individuals. If you're having trouble meeting your bills, it's just two ways to comment. It's third grade math. It's like gaining weight. You know, you can start taking in, you can start taking in more money and start having, cut your expenses down, or you can do both of them. You can do either one and make improvements, or you can do both of them. And if you're putting on weight, you can start burning more calories, or you can start taking less in, or you can do both of them. And it's third grade math. You know, I mean,
right.
It's all it is. You know, where it's on a big basis, an individual, or where it's for a company, that you can't get around simple math. You know, you can change your situation by changing the plus and minus factors, or do them both and get there quicker.
Don, let me ask you, is it true, because you talked about the plus and the minuses of you can do both. You can make more money and you can spend less so that, you know, that you're not living beyond your means. But many Americans and many countries, we found out, you know, live at 125% of their means at all times. So more money is not the answer on its own. Is that correct?
No. It's a behavioral thing. I would say psychology, but that scares people. But it's a behavioral thing. And Mr. Stone, I use his quote in my book I'm working on, Personal Finance. He said,
right,
if you can't save a little bit of your earnings, success is not in you. And what I'm saying is, if you get a first job making, I know what my first one was, but pick any number, you get a job making $20,000, you say, man, I'm just barely getting by, but when I get to making more money, I'm going to start saving a little bit. No, you're not. It's going to get taken up just like you did then, because it's not the amount you save. It's like reading The Richest Man in Babylon, applying that fable. You save a little bit when you're not making so much. It'll be easier as you go along. It's a habit. I don't care if it's $2 a payday. It's the fact is that you save money out of every check you get, becomes a habit. And over a period of time, it'll make all the difference in the world. But it's also the other way around. If you continuously spend a little bit more than you're making, you know, you're going to be in trouble. You know, it's just simple. You're going to be in trouble, because the month that you spend more than you make to ever get even, some month's going to have to be that you spend less than what you make to ever get even. You can't get if you got a credit card maxed out, getting another credit card ain't going to solve your problems. I mean, you may think it will, but it doesn't solve your problem.
Yeah, it's not sustainable.
You're just making the problem harder to solve. And that, in fact, is that's the difference in people who are just common laborers that gets in credit problems. In a sense, it's easier to stretch out than people who are in a medical field or in a professional field that get in trouble, because those people, credit's been so easy to them, they're simply in debt a lot more
money. Yeah, they're just poor at a higher level.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And if you don't have the ability to have, you know, these four reasons to have money, and I've read everything you can imagine on it. The first one is the basics. And I use Eisenhower's quote, the first basis is shelter and clothing and food.
Right.
And Eisenhower said, if that's all you want out of life is a roof over your head, clothes on your back, and food, they give you that in prison. You get all three of them in prison if that's all you want. And that's surviving. That's not really living. And that's,
right.
But the second reason is, you need money because of a rainy day. Sometimes things happen that you don't count for. Someday we'll get disabled and can't go out to work every day, and we'll need to provide for that. And the third reason is to have a good life. It's like your spouse says, Debbie, let's go out and eat tonight at that new restaurant. And you say, you crazy? I ain't paid the house payment. So it really takes money to what I say is a good life. That means travel and to do some things to enjoy a life more than just surviving. And the fourth reason is it puts you in a position where you can help others or other causes, whether it be St. Jude's Cancer Society, your grandkids kids that go to college, or the church, or some charitable thing. Money of your choosing, don't mean you got to, but that's the four reasons for money. And you can think all you want to, and you read every book that's out there. That's the only four uses of money. And so when I told that, when somebody said, well, how about Mother Teresa? She never had no money. I said, Mother Teresa never had no money. My God, she had millions of dollars as gift to her. She couldn't have done nothing without the money. I said, it took money to feed those people. It took money to clothe them. It took money to do that medical work. It's true that she didn't make the money. It was given to her, but it took money, and she made use of that money. So basically,
she went on the promotional tours, man, because she had to keep the money going. She didn't just stay in the orphanage.
Well, you know, if you really know her story was, she had an attorney. She sued people that was using the likeness of hers for other causes, what have you. She's birth protected of her Mother Teresa image, you know, and she actually sued people because they were basically taking off on her, you know. So,
right.
So she did use money. And as one of the good friends said was, I've heard Zig say also, he said, people says not money's not important. He said, they'll lie about other things.
I'm glad you brought it up, Don, because this is recently a pet peeve of mine. I heard somebody say recently, and it sounds really good when you hear it, you know, as a financial person, you'll probably get this, that you need at least 6 months of reserve in the bank, you know, when you're working. And I thought, well, that sounds really clever, and I can see where people would get behind that. But actually, I don't really think that's a good idea, because you were talking about saving 10% or whatever percentage you can put back while you're working, and you get in the habit of doing that all through your life. And to me, what I keep hearing and what I keep learning from my mentors is that what you're trying to do is build up that golden goose, the big pile of money that everybody says, why do you make more money than you can spend? The reason is because you really want to stop spending the money you make and start living off the interest. And if you can build up that capital to the point where you live comfortably off the interest, then you're truly wealthy. Does that make sense?
Here's where my goals was, because I was a bank president, you know, that was good money. I thought, now, I get to the point where I'm making more money on the side than I'm making on the job, then I'm doing okay. And that was a goal. And you can't do it overnight. Most of the time, unless you won the lottery, it takes you years to do that. Yeah, that's true. I don't want to do 6 months. What are you supposed to do when the 6 months is up? I mean,
right. No, most of my friends in real estate have now had to survive the last 2 to 4 years without money.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right. I can look and see how much, you know, I had a lot of money on getting a 5.5-6% for you, you know, and you're not getting it today. But I love what Michelangelo said. Goes back a long, long time ago. He said, it's not that we set goals as too large and we fail. It's that we set goals too small and we succeed. So that's why I would apply that 6 months into that. Okay, we got to have 6 months income, and we've done that, and we've considered we're there. Like you said, them guys out in the real estate business 3 or 4 years. I believe that one of the guys said was make as much money as you can so you can give away as much money as you can at some point. You know, so I just set an artificial limit there. I was like saying, I mean, I had a girl in the bank one day. Not recently, she said, Betty said, well, I just don't care enough about money. I said, Betty, don't sit there and lie like that. I said, I'll go by your boss there and tell him that you don't need any more raises. She said, it don't mean that much to me. I said, don't say that. You can't attract what you're repelling. You know, I said, it's like saying, Lord, don't let none of them people do well, but would you set me up? I mean, you can't attract what you're repelling, and I would apply that to money also. And people says money's not important. I mean, you know, it's not the most important thing in the world, but it's right below oxygen. It's real close to being in the society we live in. It's extremely important. And people, it says it's not important. You can bet your bottom dollar they got very little. They got very little.
Yeah, Don, you ever hear that story about, you know, God comes to this guy and he says, listen, you know, here's the deal. There has to be a tallest mountain and the lowest valley, you know, the hottest desert and the coldest, you know, snowy place on earth. You know, life in the universe is about extremes. Well, I just wanted to tell you, and I wanted to tell you in person, that you have been chosen to be the most miserable person ever. But I'd like to try to make it up to you because I feel bad about that. So here's the deal. Would you like to be the most miserable person and broke, or the most miserable person and crazy rich? And, you know, there's no answer to that, but I think that 99% of us would choose, well, if I'm going to be miserable, can I be rich and miserable so at least I can eat?
Well, I think one of the old guys that said it pretty well was, he said, I'm opposed to all rich people. Just don't offer me their money. You know. And I think that says it pretty good. The people that don't have anything, they may be opposed to it, but they would like to be in the same position.
Right. You know, and you're down south, and I live down south, and I used to live in Louisiana. I've lived in Pascagoula, Mississippi. I've been down in that Irish Bayou and Poydras and Beauregard Parish, and I've seen people that have nothing that are extremely happy, and they don't have a whole lot, but they're really happy. And so I don't think it takes money to be happy, but believe me, they did struggle every day with the money issue. So, again, the person who comes to me and says, you don't need money to be happy, I would agree with that. On the other hand, they did struggle, and if they had money, they wouldn't have had to.
But it's easier to be with it than without it. I mean, you know, it's if nothing else, to be comfort or we speak here to be service. And you can't do a whole lot to help other people without some.
No, that's true.
Without some.
And that's
money,
a biggie. As the world needs to shift toward people finding things greater than themselves, and doing. Acts of, forgiving and doing acts of kindness.
Yeah, in fact, is a copyrighted title to a book, More Than a Millionaire, Leaving a Legacy, and that was basically what I would be saying it's just more than about making money. Lots of people made money and are miserable, or have no friends, and the making the money was their final destination. And not what good they can do is, my stories are that a kid that worked for me for 6 years, just got a, worked for me 6 years back in high school. She was valedictorian. Looked like she was about 12 years old when she left here. She went to pharmacy school, made straight A's, and she starts off $125,000 a year. Her dad's an underground coal miner. Now that's to me, and ain't nothing in it for me other than just a good feeling that you might have had a little bitty part to play in the thing. And that's good enough.
Let's go into that. Let's talk about. I know I got to get you back on schedule here, and we're almost up to hour here. But I did want to talk about the Napoleon Hill Foundation and your altruistic stuff they're doing with prisons. Could you mention that and talk about that?
Yeah, it's funny. I guess it was up in November. I spoke to a prison, federal prison, and I was sitting there waiting for the warden to introduce me, and I looked at my watch and I saw it was the 14th of November, and it was my mother's birthday, and she'd been dead about a few weeks, and I thought, Mom would be proud of this. We've seen so many stories. Back in October, I had a guy invited to speak. His name was Corey Blount. Corey played with Michael Jordan. He played for the Bulls. He's making $1.8 million a year. Played 12 years in the NBA. Big old guy, 6'10". He 3 years or so after he got out of ball, he was bankrupt and in prison for drugs. And he took our material while he's in prison. And today, as I got an email from him the other day, and he'd spoke out in, I believe, California, somewhere out west, he'd spoke to 8,000 kids basically about our material. And he came here to speak and to the college kids, and they just loved him because he brought me a pair of his shoes. He got worse, size 18 shoes. But, you know, you can't affect all of them, but there's a lot of them just got off on the right track, got off on the wrong bit and all. But we've had a lot of positive stories. I mean, one guy wrote a book, and Reagan gave him his voting rights back before he left office. Of course, the guy's dead now, but he wrote a book called "Who Cares About Me?" As Bill Sands, he went to prison serving two life term sentences, and I don't remember how many years he served, many years, and he finally got out and he went around. I think he gave over 3,000 speeches to high school kids, so warned them about drugs and trying to get them off on the right track. So we do know we've accomplished a lot, and I got here on my desk one of the guys, the instructors up in Ohio, and we don't pay them guys, it's done through a church. They wrote letters of thanking for taking the material, and he sent me a big old envelope full. It must be 50 letters in there that those prisoners he wrote thanking for being able to take the material in prison. So we know we don't reach all of them, but hey, listen, just like a kid, for everyone that gets off on the right path, then that's that much.
Well, Yeah, no, that's great, and we thank you for that. This is J.W. Najarian with On Purpose Magazine, and I'm speaking to Don Green, the CEO, 13 years now, CEO of the Napoleon Hill Foundation. And, Don, you know, I like to end these interviews by giving my interviewee, that be you, the last word. You just came, you're coming out with a book in April, and it'll be on I think you can pre-order it on Amazon now, can you not?
Yeah, the pre-order's been real good. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Pals. It'll be in the Books of Millions and in the stores. It's also on Kindle as an e-book, and I'm told it'll be an audio book also. So I hope, and it's taken in front, all the proceeds go to the kids' scholarships. And the reception's been real well. I think it'll end up in 40 or so foreign languages within a short period of time.
Well, that's excellent. Where can we find? The book is called Everything I Know About Success, I Learned from Napoleon Hill by Don Green. And where can we get this? We can get this, like as you said, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. Where can we find NapoleonHill.org?
Books a Million. And if they look on our website, www.naphill.org. The book's posted on there, and it'll click on to where they can order it from. And if I hear from people, I've got, golly, I don't know what the checks I've got where people want an autographed copy. We'll do whatever it takes to get the book.
Okay, yeah, you have a place on the site where they can contact the organization, and they can request a signed book.
Yeah. Yes.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, so everybody, go pre-order. Get this thing pre-ordered. That'll help bust it out bestseller before, you know, when it comes out, and get the message out. I'm going to go ahead and let you give the last word about everything you know about success that you learned from Napoleon Hill.
Well, I got a brother who's down in Belize now this week doing missionary work, I think. As I told him one day, when we leave this world, people are not going to give a hoot about what we got out of life. They're not going to care about our bigger houses or cars or what have you. But if they have any concern for us, or if they put any place statues, it'll be for what we gave back. And that's what we're trying to do, is to give back.
Don Green, thank you so much, sir. Don, I really appreciate you coming on today. I know you're a busy guy, and I want to also thank...
I'm going to be in San Diego the last weekend. I guess the 27th and 28th, I'm going to be somewhere with Greg Reed and Sharon Lecter and
The Secret Knock.
But, yeah, I'll be at that, I think. And I think Greg's got a couple hundred books in out there and to ask me to autograph for them out there.
Oh, very good.
Of my book.
Yeah, go to Greg Reed's site, Greg S. Reed, and you can find out more about The Secret Knock. You have to be invited, but if you go to Greg's site and you tell him who you are and why you should be at this Secret Knock, you will get an invite. Like I said, he doesn't put out any advertisement, so you got to be invited and you got to convince him that you should be the one. But if you get in, then you will get to meet Mr. Green, and he can sign a book for you there, and that would be super. And there's going to be a lot of great people there. I mean, Don.
Yeah, they got Frank, the guy that's founded the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Yeah, it's a super lineup of people, very, very, very impressed. And, you know, sometimes you can spend a few hours with a group, a small group. It'll break up into groups of five or six or whatever to have discussions. You know, I remember what Queen Elizabeth I said was, you know, we can learn from each other. Even monkeys can do that.
Yeah, this is gonna be super great because they got Gary Goldstein, producer of Pretty Woman, Mothman Prophecies, Under Siege 1 and 2. They have the inventor of the cell phone, and like and on. Just an incredible mastermind that you're not gonna. It's a once in a lifetime kind of mastermind that you're not gonna find anywhere else, and so it's gonna be great. The other one is go to naphill.org, and that's where you can find Don Green and the book, or find it on Amazon. Don, again, thank you very much, and thank you to Greg Reed for helping me set this up with you.
Well,
he's a great guy.
Thank you for helping the promotion. We appreciate it very much, and I'm sure we'll cross paths before long.
I hope so. Take care.
If I can help you, let me know.
I sure will. Everybody, have a great day and an even better tomorrow.
Thank you for listening to our Made in Media Group production of On Purpose Magazine. You can find On Purpose Magazine at onpurposemagazine.com. On Purpose Magazine and JW On Purpose is the property and is a trademark of Meta Media Group, and this audio is copyright 2012, and all rights are reserved.